To many of our listeners, the president of Deaconess Health System has become the local Dr. Fauci, keeping us informed and safe during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with Dr. James Porter. For the past year, Dr. Porter has been on the front lines, making sure his own employees are safe and managing the ever-changing response to the novel virus. The war room at Deaconess, the highs and lows of the battle against COVID-19, and dealing with the concerns of patients and staff on a daily basis. A lot on Dr. Porter's plate. We also learn more about Dr. Porter's life outside the boardroom, growing up on the family farm, and spending countless hours in the pool with his aquatic family. 2 Main Street is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Tri-State Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Have you got your shot yet? It's a conversation starter these days. The COVID-19 vaccine is finally entering the arms of thousands of Tri-Staters as we mark the one-year anniversary of the pandemic. To answer that first question, I've had both my shots, the Pfizer vaccine, no side effects. My wife has one shot to go. My daughter, who's a school teacher, just received her first dose of the vaccine, so we are making progress. It's been quite a journey to get to this point. Business shutdowns, virtual classrooms, family separations, loved ones getting sick, some unfortunately dying. A malaise that can really take a toll on one's physical and mental well-being, but the vaccine has been a turning point. During the pandemic, we were barraged with information on how best to prevent the spread of the virus, social distancing, mask wearing, avoiding large crowds, and frequent hand washing. And there were counterclaims that these measures were probably overkill, not really needed. And all of this back and forth took place in a highly political climate. We wanted and needed someone to give us facts. Nationally, Dr. Anthony Fauci emerged as the voice of reason, taking a lot of heat, but following the science. Locally, Deaconess Health System President Dr. James Porter has been on the front lines of the pandemic, sorting through the information, changing almost daily, maybe hourly, and he's been helping us make some sense in the best decisions for our health and the health of our families. So, Dr. James Porter, welcome to 2 Main Street. Good to have you here.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
It has been a whirlwind year, hasn't it?
It has been unforgettable.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks
good,
for asking.
Good. Now, I must tell our listeners that we are socially distanced here. Of course, I've had both of my vaccines. You probably have too.
I've had both mine.
We're separated by a glass barrier here, so we're being very politically correct, definitely. Okay, let's go back to the spring of 2020. You probably don't want to go back there. But the initial spread of virus, when did you know, Dr. Porter, we were in trouble?
March 18th is the first time that we at Deaconess and I took to social media feeling like we needed to sound the alarm. We knew that the pandemic was underway. It was pretty clear what was about to happen and what people were going to become more aware of. It was also pretty clear that in the United States, including here locally, a lot of folks didn't yet understand the seriousness of the situation, and we felt like it was important to do what we could to start raising awareness among people that we needed to start taking measures right away, or else it was going to turn into ultimately what it turned into.
Of course, the first issue, everybody was concerned about hospitals being overrun with patients and not enough ventilators. So that had to be a moment of panic, maybe?
Yeah, there was a lot of fear. There was fear on multiple levels. I think people were concerned about resources being overwhelmed. And, you know, we were seeing in New York and other places early on when there were some terrible outbreaks in skilled nursing facilities where many people died. And you know, there were even places that were needing accessory morgues for all the folks who unfortunately had passed away. We weren't seeing that yet here, But I remember concern among doctors, you know, as to how much risk do I have of dying of this. I can remember talking about morticians being concerned about what special measures did they need to take if they received a body of someone who had died of coronavirus. And so, you know, knowing the history of Ebola and some other outbreaks that were different and more lethal in a different way, people were just scared. And mostly it was because we just didn't know so much at the time.
Now, was there like a war room at Deaconess where everybody got together and came up with plans?
We did. We stood up our disaster preparedness and response team, realizing that it was going to be different than anything that we had dealt with before. So we have something called Incident Command, which is a really well-planned, it's something we practice for. Usually we think of things like tornadoes and other natural disasters, but the same infrastructure works well for things like a pandemic. And so we stood up our Incident Command team and started making contingency plans. One of the big concerns early on was personal protective equipment, as you'll recall. So we were taking inventory of what we had and beating the bushes to try and figure out how to get more. And I can't tell you how impressed I was and how proud I am of the entire team of people at Deaconess and really in the health system in general, and how they rose to this occasion. You know, sometimes our darkest moments also have the opportunity to be our finest hours, and I think we saw a lot of that over the last year.
Did you have a stash of toilet paper?
My wife was in charge of toilet paper, and she did a fine job of procurement. There was a group of women who would give each other text messages if Sam's or somewhere had some, and so she was on the ball. We never went without toilet paper, I'm happy to say.
Now, early on, it became clear this would not be a nationwide plan. Each state would have to deal with the pandemic separately. So did you have a hotline to Governor Holcomb?
You know, we didn't have a hotline to Governor Holcomb, but I do have to say that the leadership at the Indiana State Department of Health has really been outstanding from the very beginning. So Dr. Christina Box and Dr. Weaver have both been very accessible. I have both of their cell phone numbers and can text them. And they offered that really to all the healthcare leaders around the state. And I think, you know, one of the unique perspectives that we have here in the tri-state is that we serve all three states. And each response has been a little different, but I think one of the things we've observed is that the Indiana State Department of Health really has done an outstanding job of helping us manage the pandemic.
That's what I was going to ask you. Of course, you have facilities in southern Illinois and western Kentucky. You have three different state governments to deal with. So was there any bureaucratic problems there?
You know, I think probably the biggest challenge has come with the vaccine and just having to keep track of the different approach that the different states have taken around who's eligible for the vaccine and when. That's been a little confusing for people at the time. But for the most part, there hasn't been a lot of regulatory difficulty. In fact, there have been a few things done at the federal level that have really helped us. One example is some waivers that were put in place around licensure, so that we could have doctors who were licensed in Indiana do virtual care for people in Kentucky and Illinois. And we've seen a lot of that happen during the course of the pandemic.
Of course, all these plans start out on paper, but it takes people to make them work. So it was all hands on deck right away?
It was all hands on deck, and people put in some very long hours, especially early on in the pandemic, because there was so much work to do in preparation. You know, while we had been prepared for the possibility of a flu pandemic was really, you know, had been historically our biggest concern, and we had practiced for that and had a lot of contingency plans in place, but this has been different than anything that we ever anticipated or had entirely planned for. So a lot of those plans have required frequent adjustment as we've had more information and learned things.
We'll talk about that constant flow of information, which is unbelievable when you think about it. Every day there's something new. Now, there were initial concerns, you said, about the medical staff, their own safety and the safety of their families. So that had to be a top priority right away.
It was. We wanted to make sure that we had the right practices and policies in place within our facilities, that we at least minimize the risk and exposure. As I said, you know, early on, we knew so little. And I think people like Dr. Fauci were perhaps judged a little too harshly on some things because they would change recommendations. But the reality was we just didn't know. And so as new information would come out, sometimes the plans needed to change, and masks are probably the best example of that. I was one of the people early on who was thinking, how could a regular procedure mask be helpful, knowing the particle size of a normal virus and how easily that can pass through a regular procedure mask. And so, you know, when you think about that, just sort of the science of it, it's easy to think, well, they're probably not going to do us much good. We're going to have N95 respirators or something else, a PAPR, to be able to be protected. But of course, we learned differently. We learned that while wearing a mask doesn't necessarily provide that much protection for the person wearing it, it significantly reduces the amount of viral particles that they put into the air on droplets of water around them, and therefore significantly reduce the risk of transmission even when someone is positive and they're in a group of people. So we had to change our thinking about that and had to adjust how we responded to it. But there have been lots of wonderful stories along the way. Our chief financial officer, Cheryl Wathen at Deaconess, ended up getting some national press coverage because she also sews. And she was one of the people that really started working after hours beyond being our CFO. She was sewing masks. and we had a lot of people doing that and ended up with a lot of wonderful donations from the community.
Now, did you have many employees come down with COVID?
You know, we really didn't. We had people who came down with it, but most of them received some kind of exposure outside the workplace. And that's been one of the really interesting things that I think we've learned over the course of this pandemic has been, for example, there have been very few transmissions in schools, as far as we can tell from the public health data. And what we believe is that because places like hospitals and schools are so careful about our protocols around making sure that people are wearing masks and that we're using social distancing and barriers and things where we can and that there's frequent hand hygiene, that those measures are actually very, very effective at preventing the spread of coronavirus. So in those types of settings, we haven't seen a lot of people get infected. It tends to be more in their home social situations that people were getting exposed.
My guest is Dr. James Porter. He's president of Deaconess Health Systems. And I had a recent guest, Joe Blair, who was a patient at Deaconess Midtown. He told us about his experience there. He said he was moved to 10 different rooms during his treatment. He was in intensive care three times, but he recovered. Thank goodness.
Yes.
So I'm sure each patient has a story to tell.
Well, and we do our best not to have to move people around like that. But one of the things we've had to make a lot of adjustments for has been around isolation in the hospital. Our engineering and maintenance teams really did more than I ever dreamed was possible at setting up what's called negative airflow in different units around the hospital. And early on, we were concerned that that might be really important at reducing spread internally. So we created lots of areas where there are patient rooms where instead of the positive air pressure blowing air into the unit, air was actually being pulled out of the unit so that we weren't putting the virus in other places. So I'm sure that had to do with his multiple moves, that and probably being in and out of the intensive care unit.
Well, his birthday was his 60th birthday, and he was allowed to go outside and watch a parade of people come by and wish him a happy birthday. And then like, he went home the next day. That's the Joe Blair story.
Nice.
Now, okay, recently Dr. Fauci said now is not the time to spike the ball so close to the end zone. He said we're not ready to take that victory lap yet.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really hard for us as human beings to not want to say things are headed in the right direction and now we can go back to doing so many of the things that we missed. And I think there are always two sides to that coin. You know, the shutdowns early on probably were pretty effective at reducing the spread because, you know, we saw the really big spike come quite a bit later in the pandemic. So those stay-at-home orders probably worked, but they had the unintended side effect of really causing our economy and small business owners to struggle and suffer. And so I think, you know, public health is always trying to balance all those different priorities. So, you know, I agree with Dr. Fauci. I think we need to be really careful because nothing has changed about the virus. The virus is still as contagious as it ever was. Fortunately, a lot of the higher risk individuals have been immunized at this point, and I think that's going to have a significant blunting effect on the potential for another surge. However, there are still lots of people out there who are vulnerable to the virus and can be infected, and there are enough of them. If they get together, we certainly could see another surge.
So are you concerned about spring break?
I am. You know, I think outside activities we've figured out are pretty safe. If there's a little bit of a breeze to carry the virus and dilute it in the air, then it seems a lot less likely that it'll get spread person to person. But all those people who are outside doing activities probably are also going to want to go inside somewhere and, you know, have a snack or get something to eat. And those are the places where we need to be careful.
So don't let down your guard.
Not just yet.
All right. Well, coming up, more from Dr. Porter. Growing up on a farm in southern Illinois, we'll talk about that. And the impact of COVID-19 on his family and his life at the pool. A swimming family of Porters, I understand. In fact, Dr. Porter is a nationally certified USA swimming official. And he's seen Lily King in action, apparently. To Main Street is presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Dr. James Porter, president of Deaconess Health System, which provides health care services in southwestern Indiana, western Kentucky, and southeastern Illinois. The system, based in Evansville, includes 9 hospitals, the Deaconess Clinic, the Linda White Hospice Center, urgent care centers, and multiple partnerships with other regional providers. This is the one-year anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic. So, Dr. Porter, had there been moments where maybe this is just too much to handle? Have you been stressed out much?
You know, David, the role that I've been playing, I have the perspective of seeing what it's been like for the people on the front lines, in the intensive care units, in the COVID units, and they're the ones that have taken the brunt of this and borne the stress. So the role that I've played has been a walk in the park compared to what it's been like for people who have been on the front lines with really sick people. And unfortunately, seen a lot of suffering and a lot of death. And I think it's going to be a while until, as a society, we fully recover from that. I think we're going to be feeling the effects of that for some time to come still.
Well, have you heard of how some of your staff members handle their stress?
You know, I think everyone handles things a little differently. We've tried really hard to keep that as a priority. You and I talked earlier about our incident command. One of the incident commanders that we had, someone who, it was their specific job to think about the mental well-being and mental health of our employees. And so we've tried to make sure that we're offering them tools and things that they can do to maintain some balance and to unwind from the stress that comes along with being around people who are really sick. And unfortunately, so many of these people who have died of COVID-19 it's been a very prolonged course. Their respiratory status has slowly deteriorated over time, like a train coming down the tracks. You know, you could sort of see it coming. And unfortunately, most of the time known that once they get to that point, what we were able to offer them was relatively limited. So that's a tough situation for healthcare workers to be in. You want to make people better. And some of these folks, we just couldn't make better. And so, yeah, I think generally my experience has been people are handling it well, but I also think there are people out there that it's really been tough on.
Well, it would have to be very difficult for a healthcare provider to keep a dying patient away from his family.
That has been challenging. At the same time, that's offered opportunities, I think, for people to really feel like they were making a difference. We've been using virtual visits, so using iPads and mobile phones and things like that. And so, you know, that's a role that nurses and other patient care techs and others don't normally have to take on. And yet we have many wonderful stories of our caregivers really going out of their way to try and make sure those kinds of things could happen because they realized how important it was, both for the families at home and for the patients in the hospital.
Now, your wife, Christy, she's also a physician?
She's an optometrist.
Optometrist, okay. Well, she's in the medical field. You have busy lives. You have 3 daughters. And how's the family unit doing?
Well, 2 of my girls are off in college. It was interesting. The stay-at-home orders actually probably put us together as a family unit early in the year more than we would have been because their classes were all virtual and they were at home. I've hated it for them because I think, you know, so many of the kids those ages have missed out on things that are really fun, memorable times in life. But at the same time, it was nice to have them at home and be able to be together early on in ways that we probably under normal circumstances wouldn't have.
I understand one of your daughters is going into medicine. Is that right?
Yeah, they both. The 2 in college both are right now think that's what they'd like to pursue.
Good deal. Now, I understand your family is in the pool a lot when they can get in the pool. And competitive swimmers, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm really proud of my girls, so I'll take the opportunity that you give me to brag on them. My oldest daughter at 8 years old fell in love with swimming. And fortunately for Christy and I, the other two followed suit, so we weren't chasing multiple sports in multiple places. So they've all grown up in competitive swimming. My youngest daughter started when she was 4, and they've enjoyed a lot of success. All three of them at some point in their swimming career have been age group Indiana State champions in one stroke or another. My two oldest now are Division I college swimmers, and my youngest is headed that direction.
And you are a swimming official.
And I'm a swimming official. That was the best way to be close to the action.
So what does that entail? What do you do?
Well, you know, swimming's a unique sport in that it's racing, but there are also strict criteria about the actual form of the stroke. So it isn't, you know, you can't just go out and run the way you want to run. If you're swimming a particular stroke, you have to swim within the rules of that stroke. And so when you see, for example, swimming on television, generally there are a number of officials on the pool deck. For example, at an Olympic event, there'd be an official at each end of each lane and generally two officials on each side of the pool walking back and forth, and then one who's the referee and one who's the starter. So there are lots of officials involved in swimming.
So that's what they're doing when they're walking up and down.
They're observing the stroke, okay. Making sure that swimmers are staying within the rules.
Of course, we have Olympic gold medalist Lily King, a local swimmer. Have you seen her in action?
Many, many times, yes. Lily, of course, grew up, you know, swimming here in Evansville, and she was phenomenal when she was very young. We all knew that Lily had great things ahead of her. And, of course, she has more than fulfilled that expectation in becoming a world record holder and multiple Olympic gold medalists. So, yeah, it's been wonderful for my kids to grow up with that kind of a role model in the sport they love.
And we'll be rooting for her in the Olympics.
We certainly will.
Definitely. Now, you're also a runner and a cyclist. How often do you get a chance to do that?
Well, I don't know that I'm particularly good at either one of those, but they're great for stress management.
Oh, I bet.
Help me keep my sanity and maintain some healthy living. So people ask me, you know, what motivates you to run and cycle? And I say I run like my genes are chasing me. My family history isn't all that great, so I'm trying to modify my risk factors.
Now, you grew up, I understand, on a family farm in southern Illinois, and you told me near Equality. I guess that's the
correct.
Major metropolis nearby, right?
Yes, it is a very large community. No stoplights, but we do have some stop signs.
That's Saline County?
Gallatin.
Right
next door to Saline County.
Okay.
Yeah, Harrisburg is the larger community, and it is in Saline County.
So what was grown on the farm, or raised on the farm?
Corn and soybeans primarily, a little bit of wheat, but my parents got away from wheat later on, and we had pigs, and we had a hog farm. So my dad farmed until just this last year. He just retired this last year, farmed with his four brothers. And so I had the joy of growing up working with my uncles and my cousins and my grandfather. And it was a wonderful way to grow up. I was really blessed as a child.
Any oil rigs on the property?
There was oil around. We didn't have any. We weren't fortunate enough to have oil under our farm ground, but there was some of that around.
Now, I guess you had a lot of chores growing up on the farm?
I did, yes. I like to joke that my dad and his brothers thought raising hogs was a wonderful thing until the guys my generation grew up and went off to college or got other jobs, and then they decided maybe it wasn't that great of a thing to do, so they got out of pigs after my cousins and I grew up. But, yeah, we grew up, you know, feeding the hogs and tending the garden and driving tractors and mowing and all those things that you do, but we had a wonderful time together.
Now, how did you get involved in medicine then? What triggered that that gene?
You know, that's a great question. I jokingly tell people I think maybe my mother whispered over my cradle, I want to be a doctor, because as long as I can remember, that's what I felt like I wanted to do. It's a little ironic. One of the things I really liked about my dad's life was that he was his own boss, you know, that he decided what he was going to do and when he was going to do it. And the doctors that I grew up around who were mentors for me when I was young, that was what their life was like too. But when I got out of medicine, really the private practice of medicine was kind of on its way out. So I've been an employee of Deaconess since I finished my residency, and it's been a wonderful blessing, but it's not exactly what I had and thought it was going to be like when I early on thought I wanted to be a doctor.
Of course, you grew up in rural America. What's the status of medicine in rural America?
You know, it's always been a challenge. I think there's a maldistribution of doctors in the United States. Cities often have a surplus of doctors, and we see that, you know, in utilization numbers, that there are a lot more tests and things performed on people who live in those kinds of communities. Rural communities need doctors. We're very fortunate around here, though. Deaconess has had a family medicine residency since about 1974. And so there are a lot of doctors who grew up around here, come back for their residency training, and then stay, who practice in the area. So I think we're better off than a lot of places around the country, but there's always a need for more doctors in the smaller communities.
And where did you go to medical school?
St. Louis University in St. Louis, Missouri.
Mm-hmm. So not too far from here.
No, I never ventured too far from I-64. I did my residency at the University of Louisville. And did undergraduate at SIU Carbondale. And so I had only been in Louisville a month or two. I'll never forget this. I was sitting in a conference room and made some kind of comment about how I'd never ventured far from I-64 and never left the Midwest. And there was a pediatrician named Mary Smith, who was one of my attendings, who pointed out to me really quickly that I wasn't in the Midwest anymore. I was in the South.
That's very Kentucky. It is. My daughter lives in Louisville now, and she said it's a whole different vibe over there, very Southern.
In many good ways, but yes, it is a
definitely
different vibe.
Well, coming up, more of my conversation with the Tri-State's Dr. Fauci. I don't know if he likes that title or not, but it's a good title, I think. And also the advantage of being a physician instead of a business executive when there's a health crisis. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Baird Private Wealth Management. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Dr. James Porter, president of Deaconess Health System, with healthcare services in southwestern Indiana, western Kentucky, and southeastern Illinois. Dr. Porter has been on the front lines providing information and advice during the COVID-19 pandemic, a role that means constant updates and consistent messaging. Is that correct?
Hopefully. We've been trying hard to be consistent. You know, the information changes from time to time, and in those cases, we have to adjust what we're recommending and telling people. But I think, by and large, we've done pretty well.
Now, being a physician instead of a business person, do you think that allowed you to make better health decisions, I would think?
Well, I think understanding the science, you know, especially as it was emerging and changing so quickly, certainly my medical background helped a lot with that. I think with regards to helping run a health system in the modern era, it really is a balance. I think you need both. I think you need people who understand the core business, which is patient care and clinical work. At the same time, it's a very complex business as well. And so having people who have business education and understand in depth that portion of keeping a health system healthy and able to be vibrant for the community, I think, is an important combination.
Well, it's a huge enterprise, all these hospitals, and how many employees are in the system?
Close to 9,000 now.
Really?
I think we're probably the largest employer in the tri-state.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Definitely. Now, of course, these constant changes in the approach to COVID-19, it seems like we almost get daily updates on the variants and what's needed. Is that a challenge to keep on top of all that?
There's been no lack of things to talk about, that's for sure, and information to share with people. So, yes, you know, I think, but it's been a really a headline topic in the medical literature. So it's pretty easy every day to kind of check in on the things that are happening. A lot of times it does require a little bit more research, though, to figure out fact from fiction. One of the challenges at trying to be accurate and consistent is just being cautious about what's reported and when. In order to respond quickly to the pandemic, a lot of information has been released for public consumption earlier than it normally would in the scientific process. And so we are having to be careful about journal articles, for example, that haven't been through full peer review yet, but have what looks to be potentially helpful information and therefore is being getting released prior to it normally would. And I think that's one of the things that the CDC and FDA and other national bodies have been also trying to keep very close tabs on and monitor closely. But because of that, from time to time, there have been studies that have come out that have caused us to lean one way, and then that maybe by a better or larger study has been changed in the future.
Tell us about the celebration of the vaccines.
You know, that I think the biggest hope that we've had all along that there was a path out of this pandemic has been getting one or more vaccines that were effective. I don't think any of us were expecting vaccines that would be as effective as the ones that we have, and so that's really been wonderful. One of the things that the vaccines being so effective has done is it's given us a little wiggle room so that if things happen like mutations that perhaps somewhat decrease the efficacy of a vaccine, it may still be good enough. So, you know, a lot of vaccines, the flu vaccine, for example, you know, from time to time might be 60% or so effective. So that especially those first two that came out were 95% effective against the wild type virus, the original virus, gave us a little wiggle room for that to be decreased some, but still for them to be good.
Now, when the first vaccines arrived, were they the Pfizer vaccine, the one that had to be refrigerated?
Pfizer was the first vaccine to receive emergency use authorization from the FDA, and then Moderna came shortly after that.
So were you prepared for the Pfizer?
We were, yes. We knew that when the Pfizer vaccine was released, that was going to require the ultra-cold freezers, and fortunately have just a really wonderful team who's always looking for what equipment we need, who was on top of that along with our pharmacists and had us well positioned to be able to receive that vaccine.
I'm curious, how did the vaccine arrive?
Just the way anything else is shipped, except it had to come really, really cold. So it came, you know, in freezers that were able to maintain it at the temperature that it needed to be.
In delivery trucks?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Okay. And now we've got the Johnson & Johnson. Now, is that being used widely?
We haven't had as much of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine around
here.
That's
the one shot.
Yeah, it's the one shot, and it can be stored at much lower much higher temperatures than the Pfizer vaccine. I think so. It's a more established technology of the way that particular vaccine is produced, and for that reason, can be produced in much larger quantities than some of the mRNA vaccines, the first couple that came out. So I expect that we're going to see the Johnson & Johnson vaccine become a larger and larger portion of the vaccines that are administered around the country. But one of the things about that vaccine is it also is more amenable to use in places that don't necessarily have the same capabilities that we have in the United States. So I think it's being distributed more broadly globally as well because it's just easier to use.
What about side effects? Have you had many reports of serious side effects?
So, you know, with these vaccines, like so many vaccines, side effects are fairly common, but serious side effects have been pretty rare. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really common for people to have a sore arm or maybe to feel like they don't feel that well, you know, for 24 hours or so, maybe have a low-grade fever after they've received it. But the number of people who have died or had some serious complication of the vaccine has been extremely low. In fact, there haven't really been any deaths that you can clearly associate with the vaccine beyond some allergies that happen. And we figured out early on that that was a possibility and took steps to make sure if it did happen that we could treat those people early and aggressively.
Everything I've heard from people who received the vaccine is the efficient process that they went through. There was very little waiting, and the people were very friendly, and you move them in and move them out.
So we had a team of leaders from the Deaconess Clinic, where our physician practices are managed, and our pharmacy, who spent many, many hours mapping that process out and then even practicing it to figure out where were the bottlenecks going to be, where might we run into problems. And, of course, we learned along the way as well. I remember when we first stood up our vaccine clinic, we had some people getting backed up and waiting, and we wanted to avoid that because we didn't want people being exposed or at risk mm-hmm. while they were waiting in line. So we made corrections to that pretty quickly and were able to figure out how to resolve that issue. And since then, most of the feedback that I've received has been extremely positive.
What about cooperation with the other hospital in town?
No, we're friends with the leadership at St. Vincent, and we talk on a regular basis. Pretty early on in the pandemic, one of the things that our incident command team determined was that we needed to reach out beyond just the walls of Deaconess. And so we set up a number of different regularly occurring phone calls to get the right parties together for communication. So we had a regional team that had a phone call where the leaders of numerous hospitals around the region in all three states were getting on the phone and talking about what was happening and what their needs were. And another call that we established early on was a local call that included Deaconess, St. Vincent, and members of local government, the mayor, some county commissioners, and others, school corporation representatives, universities, so that we could all be on the same page, making sure we were managing the message and communication effectively, and that when there were needs, we were well positioned to address those quickly.
Just a couple more points, Dr. Porter. Booster shots. You think we'll need a booster shot for the COVID-19?
Yeah, so that brings up the issue of the variants. And, you know, one of the things we know about viruses and one of the challenges with developing a vaccine specifically to coronavirus historically has been that they mutate. And when the virus mutates, there's risk that the vaccine will be rendered less effective or potentially with the right combination of mutations not effective at all. We don't know yet exactly what impact the mutations are going to have. We've seen evidence in other parts of the world that some of the mutations are being able to subvert the immunity that was developed by people who had infection with the wild type or the original virus. That does cause us some concern about the vaccine. So I think time will tell is the answer to your question as to whether mutations will cause the need for a booster. I would say that that is a pretty strong possibility, and I know that Moderna and Pfizer have already announced that they are working on supplemental or booster vaccines related to the variants that are in circulation that we know about right now.
A lot of people have seen you on television doing reports with local newscasters, and you told me you pick different rooms in your home for those broadcasts, and the backdrop's always interesting.
Yeah, I've been asked about that a number of times. Where am I and why am I there? So most of the time I do them from my basement, and that's for a variety of reasons. We have a dog, and if anyone comes to the door, Maggie announces it very prominently, and if anyone is eating, Maggie is often requesting nibbles. So I try to stay in the basement so the dog barking won't be an issue when people are around, and then when folks are away from the house, especially if I'm running in the door fairly quickly to try and get set up to be on the 6 o'clock news, sometimes I'll set it up in the kitchen.
Okay. Now, finally, this is your chance for some shout outs to those health professionals who helped all of us get through this.
Yeah, David, I can't tell you how humbling it has been to see so many people step up in so many amazing ways to help their fellow man. And while, you know, that's expected to be part of the medical profession, that that's what you do, I think, you know, people have in many, many circumstances gone well and above and beyond the expectations. And so there are just too many really incredible stories for me to share. But I will say that, you know, our intensive care doctors have been on the front lines. Our anesthesiologists stepped up to help them out when they really felt like they were, you know, nearing the end of their rope. Our nurses have just been incredible about picking up additional shifts and working well beyond what their requirements were. Respiratory therapists, the list just goes on and on and on.
Cleaning staff and
everyone
food
in the
staff.
Health system. The people in dietary, the people in housekeeping, and they've been having to do things under circumstances that made their job much more difficult than it normally is. And so, really, from top to bottom in the entire health system, including Deaconess, St. Vincent, all of the providers, you know, in the region and around the country. As I said earlier, I encouraged people early on to just keep in mind that sometimes the darkest times also have the opportunity to be our finest hour. And I think that really has been the truth from what I've been able to see at Deaconess.
Dr. James Porter, president of Deaconess Health System, thanks for being my guest on 2 Main Street. 2 Main Street is presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. To follow the journey of a COVID-19 patient, I invited Joe and Lori Blair to share their story on 2 Main Street. Both are now doing well, but for a while, Joe was in deep trouble. Joe, you were slammed with the virus. What were those very first symptoms, Joe?
Oh, gosh. It was a sore throat and just kind of a little bit of a fever, kind of like we had the flu.
Mm-hmm. Lori, did you notice this?
She was sick at the same time.
I was sick at the same time, but with mine, it was the polar opposite. I was tired one afternoon, took a nap, woke up, and I couldn't smell for a week, and that was it. That was all I had.
Wow.
And my taste changed a little bit. Like, Raisin Bran tasted like that kasha stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You ever had that kasha?
Yes.
It's cereal, but it's not really cereal. But it kind of tasted like that to me. But I could taste something. And then I didn't get better. All the rest of the family got better. And finally, Lori and my youngest daughter came to me, who works at Columbia Healthcare, said, "Dad, you got to go to the ER. Let's go. Let's just see what they say." And I wasn't having a hard time breathing. But as soon as I got checked and they popped me in a hospital bed because I had double pneumonia, it was just, I couldn't breathe. And I'm not psychosomatic at all. So it was just, it picked that time to get me. And I was down, if you know anything about blood oxygen count, I was at like 82 to 85, which is struggling to breathe. And that started my days at Deaconess.
Now, you were at Deaconess Midtown.
Midtown.
And was it over a month?
It was right at a month.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you in intensive care at all?
Intensive care three times.
Really?
They took me to intensive care my second day and a couple of times after that. Because I would get better, and they put me in a regular room. I was in 10 different rooms.
Really?
In 30 days, I was in 10 different rooms. And then they would move me back to intensive care because I'd have what I called an episode where I'd go way down to like 80% and couldn't breathe. And
were you ever on a ventilator?
They were going to put me on a ventilator once, but I kind of said, I don't want to go on one. They said, well, we'll see. Mm-hmm. You're close. So after about 5 or 10 minutes, my levels came up, and they said, I think we're going to be okay. You're going to be all right. We'll see.
It was a surge of corona, and there were so many cases that what happened was, that's the reason why Joe was changing rooms. Some rooms would have an oxygen system that somebody might need, but Joe didn't need that much at that time, but then he needed it again. So there was a lot of changing around. So from all the nurses' stations and all the different people that I was trying to stay in contact with, as many doctors and healthcare workers as I possibly could, to kind of get answers. But a lot of times we didn't have the answers because they didn't have the answers. Everything's right. So new with this that it was very difficult to...
Very new. They would tell you because, well, I was the one who had a hard time breathing. And they would say, Joe, breathe in the flowers and blow out the candles on the birthday cake. So with your nose. Use your nose. Breathe in, blow out, breathe in, blow out. I did that as well as I could. I bring my levels back up after a while. But one day, after like 3 weeks, in came a respiratory therapist. And, well, I back up. I'm a guitar player and singer, right? So I'm feeling better after a couple of weeks. I had Lori bring my acoustic guitar. So I was playing the guitar and making up a blues song, you know, oh, the Deaconess babes, oh, the nurses are great, you know, that kind of stuff. And they were watching my numbers, and they went, your oxygen's going up. You went from 90 to 96. That's weird. And I, you know, just from singing, go keep singing. So then, about a week later, in comes a respiratory therapist, and I was breathing in the birthday cake and blowing out the candles, or the
flowers.
The flowers and blowing right. out the candles. Anyway, she said, no, breathe from your diaphragm. That's how you want to breathe. And the light went off. I was in state choir and stuff like that. They teach you to sing from your diaphragm. And so that's what I was doing. I was breathing correctly for COVID and didn't even know it. But that's one thing that we found out, and I hope, nurses, if you're listening, that's what you have them breathe from their diaphragms. And whenever I would concentrate on my diaphragm, my percentages would go straight up. And less than a week later, I got to go home because of that, you know, therapy,
mm-hmm.
basically. So, So, yeah, breathe from your diaphragm at all costs.
Now, you mentioned that everybody was kind of confused about what was going on.
Frustration, you know? From not being able to treat something that they would know. They know heart, liver. Mm-hmm. They know the things that are pretty tried and true and tested. Mm-hmm. And this thing is so unpredictable, and it just attacks different people in so many different ways.
Some people were having kidney problems mm-hmm. in the next room. I was having my lung collapsed also with the pneumonia. And there were some that had heart problems.
Right, and these things were typically things that were pre-existing conditions, mm-hmm. not with Joe, because Joe had no pre-existing conditions. He wasn't overweight. He didn't have any problems with his lungs, he was blood type O, which is the type that apparently never gets COVID. I mean, everything that wasn't
yeah,
was
right,
Joe. So it was really confusing. And,
sure.
And because of that unpredictability, I think there was just a lot of trial and error,
but
mainly.
They were fantastic, though.
They were wonderful people. At every station that I called, they would try to find out. They would put me in touch with a doctor. The doctors would call me back. So it was very great care.
It really was.
Now, you weren't able to see Joe, though, during this time, were you?
And unfortunately, right after he got into the hospital, it was our 21st wedding anniversary. So we missed
that. We
didn't see
each other then.
And then on his 60th birthday, we got to be together.
Yeah.
And that was the one. That was the time he was coming out.
They had the parade.
Yeah, mm-hmm. on his 60th birthday.
Well, yeah, tell us about the parade. How did that get started?
That was Lori and my daughters.
We were sitting there and...
What can we do for Dad?
What can we do for Dad for his 60th birthday? We wanted to do something big, but we couldn't. And a lot of people were reaching out to us from church, from... our clients, our friends, everybody who knows Joe, especially on Facebook. And so we just decided, Mamie, our oldest daughter, who works with us at the agency, said, let's do a parade. I'm going, a parade? Yeah. Okay, let's do a parade. Well, she pulled it all together. We wrote a press release. We sent it out because that's what we do with our company also for our clients. We sent it out, and it was so well received, incredibly, that we thought, okay, I guess this is going to work. And then Columbia, where Malia, our other daughter, works, had similar drive-by celebrations of, waving to the patients and residents over at Columbia. So she knew where to tell people to park, how to do it, how to manage it, and it just worked out. That
was neat.
It was a great celebration.
Now we're talking to the Blairs, Joe and Lori, about their journey with COVID-19. And so, Joe, you're sitting on curbside in your wheelchair watching the parade go by.
Yeah, waving at people. They were beeping at me, and the signs hanging out the windows. Hey, Joe, glad you're better. Happy
so
birthday.
So how did that make you feel?
Real good. Mm-hmm. It was a good 60th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, how long after the parade were you released? How long was it?
The next day.
Oh, the very next day.
The very next day. They were talking to me that day that it was possible I could go home that day. But it was the next day.
So that was your send-off, too, leaving the hospital.
Yeah, but then I had to go back
because
I got nipped by pneumonia again, only it wasn't viral. It was
bacterial.
Bacterial.
Which was actually a blessing.
Really?
Can I tell why it was a blessing?
Sure,
please.
So he was on oxygen when he came home, and he was spiking fevers. And it was...
In the afternoon.
Yeah. It was a Thursday that he would get a fever, and then the Friday, this is right after he came home. And then we called the doctor, and she said, just make sure. Go on down to the ER Saturday morning. I'm not super concerned, but let's see. So Joe went down to the ER, and I had to leave him there. And he was admitted and diagnosed with bacterial pneumonia, to which he had 3 days of 4-hour IVs for antibiotics.
Penicillin-based.
But the cool thing was it fixed him. He got home and no longer needed oxygen, no longer felt dragging. I mean, you didn't need anything at home.
I was weak because it's amazing. I had an alarm on my bed, so if I get out, the alarm would go off, and they'd run back, get back into bed. You're a fall risk. So, but when you're in bed like that for that long, your legs go. Mm. I mean, you almost can't stand up.
He lost 35 pounds in a month.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Hard to eat. When he would eat, his oxygen would go down.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Just because he'd always need the mask on, and it was...
Yeah. So how long did it take to get the legs back under you?
That was a couple of weeks before I could walk without oxygen, really. But then, you know, now I'm really strong.
Yeah.
Now, after COVID-19, do you go back for regular visits? Do you have something called pulmonary rehab? Do you still do that?
No, I was doing so well that I didn't need to do that.
Really?
So my oxygen came back pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
And... then there was some physical therapy, but I was doing well on my own because I was finally out of bed, walking around the house, and I got strong pretty quick. So I wouldn't recommend that for everyone, but, you know.
Every case is different.
This old
for
strong
sure.
Norwegian was okay, but yeah.
And you were back on the golf course pretty soon, weren't you?
Well, after 3 weeks, I tried to hit a bucket of balls and did okay. And now I'm doing real good.
Well, I ran into Lori at a grocery store parking lot, and I said, well, where's Joe? You said he was on the golf course.
Yes.
Yeah. I said, well, I guess he's doing better.
Yeah.
Well, are you guys, of course, you're big advocates for wearing masks and getting vaccinated.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And this is no joke, folks.
It's not. It's not. And you don't understand how important it is until you go through something like this, and I don't want anybody to go through it. And
we were wearing our masks. We were being careful.
Yeah. And hardly going out. We were working from home. We were
doing everything you're supposed to do.
Supposed to do.
You get slammed with it. Wow.
Alakazam, yeah.
Joe and Lori Blair sharing their COVID-19 experience. In 2020, during the height of the pandemic, WNIN, in cooperation with the Center for Innovation and Change at the University of Evansville and CAPASA Midwest, began a 7-month-long research and reporting project called COVID Between the Coasts. The project explored COVID-19 stories in 7 Midwestern states: Indiana, Kentucky, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, Ohio, and Wisconsin, and includes visualizations of demographic and COVID-19 data in that region. The COVID Between the Coasts episodes are available by clicking the News tab at news.wnin.org. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street.